You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. It's July 1st, 2020. As you might imagine, my phone has been ringing off the hook. I've been doing interviews all over the place. It's been an extremely busy time. There's also, you know, pleasant diversions going on as well. So if I haven't gotten back to some of you who have written, I apologize for that. And as always, I thank my donors, because without you, this show couldn't function. As I've said 1,000 times, this is not a part-time job. And a tremendous amount of education and ability goes into this, especially at a time of almost universal breakdown in cognition, which is the most striking thing that I see today, is the inability to think. Now, the slogans like think for yourself, whatever that might mean, we're not born with that ability, but something that has to be learned through struggle. Of course, logic is not something we create. The data is not something we create. So thinking for yourself really means to freely, autonomously come to the proper conclusion. A word like freedom, especially something like love, doesn't have any meaning in postmodern English. It's idiosyncratic. And really, it has something to do with not wanting to be under some moral code or system. To say we demand freedom is stupid and meaningless. Freedom to do what? But the moment that question is asked, you're already in trouble. If someone answers with an abstraction, you know they're hiding something. Freedom to live our own lives is an attempt at an answer. Then what would that entail, you may ask? Then they get irritated. They're hiding what they want under a meaningless slogan. In postmodernity, abstract freedom can be a disaster. Today, the U.S. serves really essentially what the United States is a large processing plant for the production of beastly semi-humans designed to purchase commodities made by others very, very far away, working for slave wages. This creature is then told that its condition is the ultimate manifestation of freedom. And worse, that it's a historical inevitability. Pumped full of psychotropic drugs, self-hate, chimerical images, physical ideologies, the American creature is shepherded through life by a pantheon of celebrities creating a dream world. This is the invented universe within which the mass man cognitively lives. The average American doesn't have any, even the vocabulary to describe his condition, let alone fight it. Very possibly, the people who might fight it will create something worse. But this is no positivist doctrine. Man does have the hypothetical capacity for free will, but freedom requires a tremendous amount of work and discipline. Freedom in the non-arbitrary sense is not something man's born with. Man is born helpless. Freedom comes through suffering and struggle with yourself, society, and both, or both. But why do tyrannies exist? Where this even becomes a problem? First, there had to have been an advanced amount of social decay in order for an oppressive system to develop. The brutalization of Europe's population after World War I In Russia, after the continuation of its civil war, are two means whereby the morals of the population were shredded. War is a common cause for oppressive systems because of the dislocation it causes. Whether you think of Antigone or even Dr. Zhivago, war wipes out all our previous conceptions. To this day, I don't understand how modernity ever survived World War I, let alone World War II. But once the moral order is shattered, systems can then arise that are based on revolutionary morals, or no morals at all. Since man is distorted already, the new system has to be based on that. But oppressive regimes can also, once peace is restored, awaken a real destiny in a very sharp way. The Soviet system created an army of dissidents who were forced to reconsider their history and how it could be adapted against the present system. Like evil itself, oppression is part of a broader whole. It wipes the slate clean so as to rebuild social life once it begins to weaken. If the system is truly oppressive, it usually falls under its own irrationality. They have a tendency not to last. The challenge is to rebuild, but rebuilding comes first from resistance. Second, oppression creates a different personality. The real is either accepted or negated. There's no third option. Solzhenitsyn said that few people actually believed in the USSR as an ideological concept. There were opportunists who mouthed the slogan for the sake of promotion. And even in the church saw the USSR as a needed cleansing, a form of rebirth. It's not an evil in itself. It's something required to remake man. Suffering is required for real knowledge. In fact, suffering is needed for anything of value to be produced. Suddenly, you can't take old institutions for granted. So the pain itself forces you to get to the root of them. Times of stress are some of the most creative, both socially and personally. Man is never determined by institutions. There is a structure to cognition that rejects any system that makes war on nature, the family, the corporation, the farm, etc. All are based on natural demand. Oppression insists that all is subject to political analysis, which means that all is subject to regimentation. Plato's entire corpus is based on living under a regime that was oppressive, unstable, and absurd. Because it was like that, the forms, archetypes, were seen as divorced from society. They're seen clearly only because society, in its absurdity, forces the mind away from it. The archetypes can be seen when they've been banished from the city. Man thought of himself as able to create his own happiness. But of course, that's never the case. Reaching to the forms became the sole goal of philosophy. In other words, philosophy was born out of oppression as a form of resistance. This means that real philosophers end up dead, on the margins of society or in prison, and certainly not tenured professionals with six-figure salaries. Philosophy, by definition, can't be done by such people, but it will be destroyed by them. And what those two entities converge into is a disconnection of justice and life, leading to one of two things, either opportunistic acceptance or active rebellion. Only a tiny proportion of the population will choose the latter, while the rest, once the war is over, will tell you how they were with you all along. Oppression isn't temporary inconvenience, as Americans might think. It's a distortion of something good. The political becomes everything. Capital rules all. Social sanction forces us to be silent. Stagnation leads to bureaucratization. Law is taken as an end in itself, as a set of formal rules, and so on. This is the nature of oppression, not in the inability to live your own life. Man, power, science, economics, or whatever, is seen as self-sufficient, and law is something that's made rather than discovered. All of these are distortions of something good. One aspect of life, such as the economic or the scientific, comes to dominate everything else. And of course, as I've said many times, oppression need not come from the state. The state isn't some abstraction. It's made up of real flesh-blood men with real agendas. But in postmodern America, the state is largely privatized, living far beyond its means, unable to enforce tax hikes, assuming that even leads to greater tax revenues. The system has privatized the state functions to the lowest bidder. It's similar to office buying in old France and Turkey. The French crown, without recourse to direct taxation like the modern state, raise cash by selling offices and titles. On the one hand, the state had loyal and wealthy servitors, while for their part, the buyer's office would have no meaning outside of the royal state. It was unstable, not only for the short term, but it's been repeated using different names. We are oppressed personally when we are slaves to desire. This is the worst form of oppression because you can't run or hide from yourself. Asceticism is a rebellion against this. But liberal democracy has no room for asceticism. In a society based entirely on consumption, asceticism is pure heresy. Therefore, those suffering from internal oppression redefine the word in purely political terms to avoid any kind of cognitive dissonance. This doesn't force us to be loyal to it, but eventually we either accept it, which is mental death, or do battle against it, which can also lead to mental death, but also lays open the way to incredible insight and, at a minimum, courage. Hegel serves as our best theorist on freedom, in the non-arbitrary sense. Like everything, freedom is historical and isn't intrinsic to human nature in the abstract. Freedom in the abstract is infinite in Hegel's system because it's meaningless. It doesn't refer to any action in particular, or even at all. Hegel argues that the person is the only thing capable of freedom, not the ego. A person, by definition, has to be a concrete aspect of the social whole and is formed by it. Freedom as a matter of the ego cannot work in any society, but certainly within the modern nation. Freedom exists in a dialectical relationship with necessity, and the two always condition each other. Nations are organized in such a way that necessity, that is to say, what a human being needs to survive and function, is not a matter of freedom, implying as it does that individuals are subject to forces over which they have no real control, and which constrain their actions even against their own wills. So where does freedom work? Certainly not the fundamentals, since all of our needs are the same. It's a matter of means. Basic needs are a matter of necessity, as well as the means whereby these are met. Men are in a condition of interdependence without which and no need whatsoever be ever met. It's not possible in modern society to satisfy one's needs without entering into a broader division of labor, called by Hegel the system of needs. And this is true of any society. Like Plato's City of Pigs, a system of basic production comes into existence through the particular individuals who enter into it. It arises spontaneously, and that no one has specifically organized it, and there's no central plan from the start. Hegel alludes to this element of spontaneity by insisting that the individual enters into civil society as someone who makes his own particular will into the end of his activity, that in civil society, the principle of self-interest is posited. Now, for most of us, we're born into a society that is ruled by passion, ego, class, external appearance, and positivism. Most of my peers went along with it because it was easier. I refused to, despite having excellent examples of success in my own household. I saw too much evil, even among those considered successful. But I also saw that people were irrational, pursuing self-interest rather than truth, which took quite a while to digest for me. So on the one hand, I was forced to lead a very different life. On the other, to some extent, affected by it all, might never be rid of its effects. Both of these are, in a sense, good, since both force me and those like me to reconsider everything, including the definition of success. Soon I was pushed to study other peoples and ways of life. Only then could I critique this one. In my personal case, it was because I was raised in the funeral business, where death was literally everywhere. Life seemed relative and fleeting. People's irrational and occasionally comical reaction to death showed me that reason is only a part of who we are. Most often, it's a tool that justifies whatever we are doing and is reluctantly indulged later, if ever we're asked to give an account for what we've done. But freedom is not an abstraction. Practical constraints exist regardless of the nature of the system. And Hegel sees this as conditions of human freedom in the sense that they get people used to restraining their immediate desires and inclinations, which then allows them to gain some control over these same desires and inclinations. People are forced to adopt a more universal view of being able to recognize the validity of laws and institutions that reflect the notion of the system's needs that can't be negotiated away. In other words, freedom is not the absence of restraint. It's not the case that individuals are subject to a purely external form of necessity, as modern liberals would think. Practical constraint is inherent to human nature. Hegel first considers people who obey the laws only because they recognize that a life of lawlessness would frustrate their purposes. These people see the state as necessary evil. If they can get away with anarchy, they'd follow that, as long as their property was protected. In other words, they conceive of living in a political society as a contingent matter, as liberalism teaches. Though much here depends on just how seriously they take this to be. It's where Western societies begin to break down. Society is no longer considered a natural object. On the other hand, Hegel regards practical constraint as the foundation of freedom, rather than something to be overcome as such. It generates a condition of interdependence, which not only predates the person, also ultimately requires the rule of law and the existence of a state for effective functioning. When Hegel considers the sort of individuals who think of themselves as living in a political society only as a matter of necessity with respect to the satisfaction of their needs, he therefore has to be taken to have in mind a type of attitude which is an illusory one, insofar as it consists in a sense, however vague, of having a choice in the matter. Of course, there is no choice and could never be. Constraint and freedom require one another. Civil society, which is neither society as such nor the state, creates classes. And these classes come to see freedom differently. The rich man, by virtue of his wealth and the power it brings to him, comes to think himself as free from the constraints imposed on by others by the condition of interdependence which underlies civil society. This is because wealth appears to allow the rich to do anything they want to do and to dominate others who are made to act in accordance with his personal ends, as if they're universal ones. Given the apparent independence of others, which he enjoys in virtue of his wealth, the rich man also has no need to be a member of a form of association like a corporation or the modern guild. The powerful are free of the constraints which membership of such an association would impose on him. When this claim is taken in conjunction with what Hegel says about the class that suffers dependence and want, he's implying that the extent to which one experiences the absence of constraint in modern society will be proportional to the amount of economic power that one enjoys. But is a rich capitalist really free? Well, certainly not of the condition of interdependence and the practical constraints that it imposes on the human will found in civil society, as he senses himself to be. And the wealth and power he enjoys are themselves a result of his workings of economic laws, governing the market relations to develop on the basis of the condition of interdependence. A lot of this is taken from an excellent article published in 2012 in Theoria, Journal of Social and Political Theory, entitled Subjective Freedom and Necessity in Hegel's Philosophy of Right, a work that I've always considered to be one of the greatest political works of all time. And, you know, someone who is wealthy can explain the subjective experience of freedom because of the absence of constraint. On the other hand, it's possible to think of him as someone whom the necessity which underlies civil society nevertheless remains partially concealed. A prison remains even if it's paved in silver. This is what makes Hegel interesting. You know, he might be the beneficiary of the economic system which operates in civil society. He can only act in accordance with this system's laws, or at most, seek to make sure that they operate in his favor. He doesn't make these laws, nor can he firmly determine their particular outcomes, which are, after all, determined by countless arbitrary choices made by others, over which he has no absolute control. The capitalist may attempt to make sure, in association with others, that the dice are firmly loaded in his favor. Yet his actions remain subject to necessity, even if not to the same extent that those people with less economic power than he has. St. John Chrysostom makes the claim that the wealthy are far less free than others because of the contingency of their condition, One lawsuit, one corrupt judge, one audit, or even a riot or a war can bring it all crashing down. So by introducing the notion of subjective freedom in the philosophy of right, and stressing the notion of necessity in his theory of civil society, Hegel goes a long way towards comprehending a specific aspect of modern freedom. He develops in his accounts of the abstract right and morality a conception of the modern individual as people capable of exercising free choice and determining notions of the good, but that only takes us so far. On the other hand, he draws attention to the possible concealment of the necessity underlying the modern experience of freedom. Liberalism goes far out of its way to conceal this dependency, or interdependence, which would undermine its existence. In this respect, emphasizing the concept of freedom while ignoring that of necessity threatens to provide a one-sided account. But this is in the nature of liberalism, and why it's to be rejected as absurd. One of the main virtues of Hegel's account of civil society in that work is the way in which it reveals a necessity that underlies the modern form of ethical life, which may remain concealed from the modern people with their strong conception of themselves as free. This invites the question of what it means to recognize the existence of such necessity. Some of us who do this full time, we often ask ourselves, what would I be if the world were a just place, or at least, you know, generally defensible? I have no idea. I guess I would have gone to my father's funeral business. I wouldn't have any reason to question much, at least not fundamentally. I could live for the moment. But that's not obvious, such a life is better than what I have now. But it wouldn't be inherently sinful either. If society were normal, what would we be doing and thinking? Well, Alexander Dugin deals with the vision of liberalism and its lies, deliberate deceptions. Dugin is a Platonist, as I am, and Plato realized that when ideas exist in their pure form, they're not subject to corruption. But as soon as ideas start to be realized, they immediately undergo decomposition and decay. Therefore, from the point of view of philosophy and human history, utopia is a very serious, very important, and a very real substance. After all, when utopia arises, the place that is not subject to decay, the imperishable sacred place, forms in the human spirit. When utopian thinking was overcome, utopian models become a part of many ideologies. One of the constituent parts of Marxism was French utopianism, which described an immediately realized communist reality. So Dugin says, despite the fact that these utopian ideas seem to many very strange, unthinkable, and absurd, they were partly embodied in Marxism and implemented in Marxist political projects. And he says this at greater length. It's very important to pay attention to the fact that projects are very important to a person in principle. Every morning we start by making a plan for the day, make a plan for the week, for the rest of our lives. What is this? It's utopian. If you want to do what is not yet. To a large extent, utopia absorbs all our thoughts, our dreams, our fantasies about what's coming, the new. The habitual utopia in our plans is considered as something routine, unprincipled, unimportant. Therefore, utopian descriptions emphasize something new, unexpected, and unusual, which is not a common practice. Many philosophers have noticed that a material person, largely engaging in satisfying carnal needs, by and large, doesn't consider himself to be such. Being largely an animal, man categorically opposes this thought. But what distinguishes man from animal? Utopia. Animals have no utopia. It agrees with the condition in which it is, but man does not. So how do utopias influence political ideologies? The influence of the utopian socialists, people like Thomas More, and Tommaso Campanella, on communist ideology is well known. They drew an image of society based on social justice and inspired many in the 19th century. Philosophers, practitioners, workers, and labor movement that in the next century, a third of the planet attempted to put into practice. there's utopias that are not only communist or otherwise. People like Francis Fukuyama wrote his famous book on the alleged end of history. And he ridiculously applied the end of history mythos to the vapid liberal ideology. Hegel argued had to be overcome. In the 1990s, the idea of the end of history, where there are neither states, nor ethnic groups, nor cultures, only one world market, was practically realized. It was very short-lived, and the natural order of tribes and nations soon reasserted itself, though. So, the element of utopia is particular to any particular ideology. Belief in utopia revives even the most liberal, focused only on the mind and material interests of people, political and ideological forces. My master's thesis advisor, Lyman Sargent, is one of the defining scholars in utopian thought. And as part of his definition of utopia was a notion of considerable detail, both in theory and practice. And these were often under the most minute control of either ideology or actual physical controllers. Man, at least a handful that are sensitive, it's a creature that is inextricably and irreversibly associated with utopia. We know that many of us will not reach the top, but if we stop striving upwards, if we lose this utopian horizon from the scope of our attention, we will collapse, give up, and turn to nothing. While we live, we have a project. That is what life is. We live because of a dream, without even admitting it sometimes, because sometimes it is frighteningly distant. Dugin spares no words, though. He says, liberalism is a disgusting, misanthropic, vile teaching. It is disgusting in theory and practice. If we knew what was behind the beautiful foreign word liberalism, we would have recoiled, were horrified, and rushed to run away from it as soon as possible, for as long as possible. It's time to call a spade, we have been confused for too long. Well, after what that ideology did in Russia in the 1990s, it's no wonder how many wanted Stalin back. But at first glance, liberalism refers us to the idea of freedom, from libertas. But freedom and liberalism is nowhere to be found in Russia. At least in the negative sense. It's best to refer to the generally accepted theorist of liberalism, I would say John Stuart Mill. What does he tell us about freedom? As a respectable English gentleman whose name adorns philosophical dictionaries and scientific encyclopedia, the Venerable Mill cannot be wrong. He knows better. He is the dominant element. But there are two freedoms, which are denoted by different English words. Freedom as liberty, and freedom as a lack of constraint. These are completely different things. Liberty is a concept from which the term liberalism originated, of course, but that's not accurate. Liberty, according to Mill, is negative freedom. It's freedom from something. But all first-year students in political science know. For Mill, though, that was freedom as such. Mill specifies the task of the liberals is to free themselves from socio-political, religious, state traditions, and mutual obligations. Freedom from is freedom of an individual from society, from social connections, dependencies. Liberalism insists that the measure of all things is the trading individual. That is the meaning of being and the terminus of life. Freedom to act is a freedom to trade. It's always been an economic matter. The mercenary individual is driven by egoism and greed. And egoism and greed are considered virtues of liberal philosophy and should be taken as a universal standard. All legal, administrative, moral, religious, social restrictions must be lifted from it. The arbitrariness of its whims, the interests of calculations, and its benefits form the basis of a new value system. Therefore, suddenly, the vaunted scientific exactitude of the modern world goes out the window the moment one looks at human behavior. This is why. So on the one hand, the modern world prides itself on its mathematics and science and precision with everything except actual behavior. This was an extreme innovation for its time. Today, there are no more religious or moral norms, no class obligations, no control of the state and society over economic activities. In the future, there's no state or society at all. It's a chaotic game of merchants without a homeland, faith, ethics, or cultures. It's only the invisible hand which directs this process towards the cherished goal, to make the powerful, the men who gain power through cash, sleep better at night. This is freedom from. And the negation is quite concrete. What is proposed to be free from is tangible and real things. But this person, as I've said already, is limited by many things. The process of getting rid of these barriers, moral norms, social obligations, is transparent. You know, lower taxes, fewer laws, fewer government agencies. But the tricky question arises. Why do we need this? Freedom from what is understandable, but freedom for what is different. Negative freedom is one thing, but it still can't tell us for what. Even a concern with money only goes so far. What are you going to do with it? So Mill created the concept of liberty as freedom for. Freedom for seems to him an empty and vapid concept. It frightens him, the liberals, by referring to the depths of metaphysics, to the foundation of the human spirit, to the abyss with which it's not easy to cope, so they deny its existence. Which is normal for them. Freedom for is a style of freedom that requires a higher purpose and a more fundamental understanding of man. Liberalism thrives on the shallow idea of society, even the rejection of society itself. It poses difficult questions. What is the positive meaning of life? Liberalism can't ask that question, let alone answer it. Why does a person work, live, and breathe? Where and why to direct that clot of energy with which the human baby is born in the human world, takes its first steps and grows up. Freedom for is, as Dugin says in many places, a blow, an attack. It's a new life-giving darkness where philosophical questioning throws it. It's a risk. It's madness. It's a challenge. So liberalism fails even at the level of theory. So Dugin says this. John Stuart Mill pales in front of the question. He's overwhelmed by the terrifying being of the opening of positive freedom. He doesn't know what to do with this. He folds, he hides, he moves away from the answer. Here on the horizon of European philosophy appears a lean German professor of Slavic origin. Thin yellow fingers deftly, a little squeamishly, grab the Englishman by his earlobe, his Puritan ear. Friedrich Nietzsche, brilliant, merciless, fatal, like the wind of the desert. Do you call yourself free? I want to hear your dominant thought, not that you've thrown off the yoke. Do you have the right to throw off the yoke of yourself? There are not a few who have lost their last value when they were freed from their slavery. Free from what? What a matter of this, Zarathustra. But your clear look should tell me, free for what? So, in this passage, liberals were finally destroyed. Cross is placed on them if you were able to overcome the curse of Zarathustra. Freedom from is the aspiration of the eternal finished slave. The free spirit chooses to live freedom for only. Liberalism is a political platform for freaks and rogues who seek to legally preserve the loot, the stolen, that which is expropriated. So far, this has been a Duganite understanding of the development of the concept of liberty. Clearly, you could see its relation to what's happening in the U.S. and Western Europe today. I laugh at people who want to abolish the police but won't give any concrete proposals for what's going to replace them. Sending mental health workers to break up a gang brawl is absurd. And they have not so far given this. It's always a freedom from some kind of restraint. But for what purpose? You say Black Lives Matter or White Lives Matter, you say why? Why is that the case? What are these people going to do? Well, let me clarify this a little bit. Friedrich Hayek, who... Remember, he's unjustly considered an individualist. And he says this, which is to dispel this kind of mythology. He says, I can give no better illustration of the prevailing confusion about the meaning of individualism than the fact that the man who to me seems to be one of the greatest representatives of the true individualism, Edmund Burke, is commonly and rightly represented as the main opponent of so-called individualism, Rousseau, whose theories you feared would rapidly dissolve the commonwealth into the dust and powder of individuality. Not the term individualism itself was first introduced to the English language through the translation of one of the works of another great representative of true individualism, de Tocqueville, who used it in his Democracy in America to describe an attitude which he deplores and rejects. There can be no doubt that both Burke and de Tocqueville stand in all essentials close to Adam Smith, to whom nobody will deny the title of individualist, and that the individualism to which they are opposed is something altogether different from that of Adam Smith. The distinction he's making is a classically conservative one. The individual isn't a person. He's an abstraction. The person is concrete. The individualism of the modern world is a disease. The psychiatrist Lyle Rossiter, proving that going from one field to another is a terrible idea, says this. Individualism insists that an individual's freedom to live as he chooses may not be subordinated to any collective-based rules beyond those essential to ensure social order and equal liberty for all individuals. It insists further that in order to preserve the agency, autonomy, and sovereignty of individuals, official policy decisions must first give importance to the individual, not to the group, and especially not to a government. The only legitimate function of government is to foster the lives of citizens by protecting their rights as individuals, not as members of a class or a group. No collective cause should ever be allowed to override these rights. Individualism opposes any conception of the state or other collective as primary in value over the individual. In particular, it opposes any notion that the individual exists for the good of the state. Now, note that he condemns also moral relativism, as if that is somehow different from individualism. It's not uncommon for amateur political analysts to say that conservatives believe in limited government, individualism, and capitalism, apparently unaware that these are revolutionary doctrines from the Enlightenment. Conservatism came into existence precisely to fight these doctrines. Another error made by people like that is the inability to distinguish between communities and collectives. In fact, they have little in common. The notion that the individual, that is the ego, is the center of all things can only come from the American at the end of a dying empire. They're often surprised to know that the writers think that their individualists are nothing of the kind, as Hayek shows above. The individual is a mythical creature of the post-industrial age. He literally possesses nothing. Ideas, language, logic, and politics are all communal possessions. So I quoted Lyle Rossiter to show the absurdity of his position. The great Russian philosopher Ivan Ilin, the article Russian National Self-Government. The argument here is that men take the universal truths of the faith and situate them in a Russian context. There's no generic orthodoxy. It all must be embedded in some cultural language. The concept is the individual, too, is enculturated. The person can only come from a collective. I'm sorry, from a community. So in the Russian case, nationalism is crucial because the Soviets were systematically destroying the memory of the people. Westerners are ignorant of Russia and believe, you know, Russians to be inferior. Westerners, of course, use abstract freedom as a way to beat Russians over the head with Ronald Reagan even making a stupid comment that there is no Russian term for freedom. Now, Ilin also wrote, what can Russians learn from Zionism? Now, Israel was founded as a utopia. It's dedicated to a sacred geography. It's not needed for nationalism. Utopia is the end times, when as soon as the Jews kill enough people, the Messiah will come. This kind of delusion destroys nationalism. It can never be about utopia, superiority, or conquest. Wars are only defensive. Nationalism mandates tolerance for all other nations, even ones you don't like. The only time violence is justified is to defend our people. The problem here, and why individualism is dominated in America specifically, is the same reason why nationalism was never really developed in this country, because the U.S. has no culture. It's an alienated, identityless mass. They don't know what solidarity is. So the church here, or really any institution, tends to be generic. And they pick which traditions suit them at a given moment. But remember, nations are God's creation. If individualism is false, then nationalism is true. Nations are God's creation, no different than individuals are, as are languages. Now, of course, nations can't be the sole source of loyalty, but from a political and ethical point of view, they can situate our specific approach to orthodoxy and our mission within it. It's a way to overcome the alienated individualism that Hegel speaks about. Almost all the time, the idiots I debate, knowing nothing of the massive literature on nationalism in English, Serbian, Ukrainian, or Russian, the definitions of nationalism are arbitrary and emotional. Really, your best bet is to make certain to define your terms as the ethnic-cultural community, not the state apparatus. The greatest of Russian nationalists, such as Komiakov or Kirivsky, were very hostile to the state as such. Solzhenitsyn is another resource, like Dostoevsky is too. In my book on Ukrainian nationalism, I quote Donstov, the Church of Nationalism, and he says this, and this is my translation from the Ukrainian. Modern nationalism is about traditionalism, faithfulness to our homeland, customs, family, and the race. These can become idols, but they need not be. The individualism of the anti-nationalist is a delusion, in itself an artificial abstraction. Modern nationalism is united with the church. It derives from the cult of ancestors, which play a huge role in the church. In Ukraine and elsewhere, the church was the very creator of the nation. National customs almost exclusively have a Christian origin. Our very literacy comes through the church, in Slavic no less. There are no abstract people. There are no abstract dogmas. All is acculturated in our experience. It is the essence of identity. Without it, we're merely a herd of abstract individuals who have no identity, culture, or any solid foundations for any beliefs whatsoever. Well, tearing down monuments isn't about monuments. It's creating a herd. But to a great extent, that herd has already existed. The nation is the bearer of tradition. It is the ethnic group and the specific historical experience it's been through. The individualist has to be anomalous, which is an abstract falsity. And it suggests that phenomena that we perceive have no intrinsic connection, can't have any intrinsic connection with one another. Pure anomalism, it's an abstract falsity, it's a subconscious, which is yet to be conditioned by our own and the world's historical reason and experience. One of the big problems of individualism and the concept of freedom is the subconscious. But for Hegel, the subconscious would refer to anything that hasn't seen its true form, hasn't become a concrete universal. So we might see a house, an occupied house. The place might be considered to be external, merely given to us, external to us. This is a notion of dogmatism. It's an assumption. Of course, our knowledge of the house is part of the very broad and comprehensive historical epistemic context we live in. But what's the distinction between the house and the home? It's not an isolated phenomenon. The two terms are connected in a real way. The difference between a collective and a community is precisely that of the house and the home. The entire point of Hegel's phenomenology is to bring these sleeping realizations to light, so to speak. What makes a house a home? Every syllable of this is historically conditioned, including these. So if we see something, an object like a house, we realize that our own categories are imposed on the object, home, and these are historically conditioned. These conditions affect how we perceive or come to know the thing, are created over time. Then there is no subconscious. The hidden content has been exposed. Only before we've reached that point can we be said to have any such thing as a subconscious. We take the partial manifestation of the thing for the entirety of the thing. The realization of the rest is asleep in us. This is the language that Hegel uses. In other words, the individualist misses a gigantic amount of human identity and focuses entirely on the ego. Everything else is repressed. In other words, if we view the world from the point of view of our subjective interests, we're only seeing a small portion of the world, and we don't understand what we see. Our subconscious, in that case, would insist on our own connection to the universal historical process, which brings all aspects of the things to light. Since such a person is ignorant of this historical connection, we can say that it remains unconscious as of now. I'm not saying that the subconscious and ignorance are the same, but when you adopt an ideology and you become habituated to it, elements that don't agree with it are repressed and crammed into the subconscious mind. So, in politics, think of it like this. For Hegel and his philosophy of right, if we consider society as just as an arena for our own economic interests, then the true nature of society lies undiscovered, asleep in our subconscious, so to speak. Once we realize that when we work, we're manifesting universal dependence, hence we begin to form truly cooperative societies and the state, the size of our subconscious gets smaller and smaller. More and more truths natural to man are coming to light. This means more reality is coming under the historical and social gaze of reason, and fewer things are hidden from it. The Russian intuitivists, the philosophical school, had the notion that whenever you perceive an object, most of what you're doing is repressing the fact that it's situated in a gigantic context. We subconsciously see the all. But for now, we're just focused on an object and usually only on one aspect of the object. So as far as Hegel's concerned, history is a process of humanity slowly removing the unconscious drives and instincts and subjecting all to reason. That is, that amalgam of historically conditioned categories that create our knowledge. They form a context that permits us to see the whole thing, the object in its full context, the whole. Then everything is conscious and reflective. But before that time, we, to some extent, have truth within us which we are not aware. Again, the subconscious is not ignorant. But there's aspects of humanity, you know, Hegel's whole doctrine, overthrowing liberalism and individualism, is a transition from what he calls civil society to the state. Civil society is simply, John Stuart Mill's invisible hand. People pursuing their own self-interest. But the conclusion is different. Smith is utopian in his view of human self-interest. He assumes that people know what their self-interest is. He assumes that they know how to carry it out. And those who carry out the best will dominate against those who don't. Now, Hegel's point of view, though, is that in pursuing our own self-interest, we begin to realize that we are tightly connected one with another. This is the foundation of the nation. The concept of the nation comes from the fact that as we work, as we create, we are utterly dependent on the culture that surrounds us. Now, of course, we live in an anti-culture now, but in a healthier time, this is where nations derive. And we begin to realize this subjectively, what had been subconsciously asleep in our minds for a long time, that we need one another. Um, becomes manifest when we realize that things like logic and the tools that we may use in our language and our ideas don't come from us. We may arrange them differently, but that's about it. In the past, I've spoken about how much I love Plato's Gorgias, as I've already mentioned. I call it the pre-modern attack on modern life. And, you know, I've always been partial to syndicalism. And I've read all manner of slogans about societies of free men or self-governing guilds. But the problem is, what evidence is there that all people, in quotes, all people, everyone, is capable of freedom? Freedom requires a profound use of reason independently of self-interest. Do workers want freedom? Freedom means that your actions are your fault, regardless of the distinction between the intent and consequence, although, you know, few see freedom that way. I use the example of self-management in Yugoslavia. The idea that workers, you know, ran the factory floor and were involved in every aspect of decision-making. But that meant that you would have to, you know, stay after work for hours of discussion on bureaucratic matters. Few workers can be bothered with details of administration. So therefore, a class of professional politicians emerged that took over this process. Tito then introduced a law that forced that out, rotational law. But passing a law has no relation to the cause of the issue in the first place. Freedom is of immense difficulty, and only few actually have or want it. Freedom is constant labor, thought, and warfare. The struggle for autonomy, not to become a plaything of the passions. I started this talk making that very clear distinction. Freedom cannot be mere surrender to the passions. This is the opposite of freedom, since these drives are immediate instinctual drives that we have really no control over. Freedom must be rational and totally autonomous. But how many are capable of that? When push comes to shove, most see freedom as an intolerable burden. Few workers want to rule themselves. They want to put in their 8 hours and go home. They don't want to go over details of production targets with suppliers for 3 hours after work every day. But the abuse of terms like all and every, the equivocation when it comes to things like individual and freedom, has destroyed political science. Gorgias is one of the most profound Platonic dialogues, and it's the introduction, I think, the best introduction to Platonic thought in general, and it's underrated. People want freedom only in the sense that they want, let me put it this way, people want freedom in the same sense that they want honesty. Only a handful really mean it, and even fewer are capable of it. Everyone has to admit at some time or another that humanity cares only about having their lifestyle validated. They want to hear what serves their current interests. Persuasion is really the issue here. How the herd is manipulated. Persuasion is, and this is the foundation of the dialogue, it's about the powerful manipulating the herd for their own interests. No one would desire a situation where the best paid lawyers would win the day in court. Truth and truth alone should matter. But this is exactly why professionals in the university cannot deal with Plato, especially in this dialogue. The notion of persuasion, public relations, manipulation of the herd, or oratory, requires a world in which no truth are accepted or understood because other than power. This is Socrates' whole argument. In a world where truth mattered, oratory as such would be a radically secondary concern. The rise of public relations and marketing and oratory is a sign of social decay. It's a sign that society has deviated so far from the divine that those most pleasing to the ear are as good as diligent researchers. And there's no distinction between them. You know, the stupid, putting Greta Thunberg on the COVID panel. The truth is that persuasion is an evil unless it's found in the true and the good. But the only alternative is self-interest. The question is not merely that producing conviction and inculcating belief. It's producing conviction among the powerful with no foundation for any truth claims. It's the will to power. It's not a free will. Power is not free by definition. And the way that Socrates knocks down this fake concept of freedom in oratory is that, and it can easily be applied to journalism, is that there is no specific craft of speaking well. They're speaking well about something, but that something would be the issue, not oratory. It's knowledge, not manipulation. You can learn just enough about a field to preach to the ignorant and sound intelligent. That's modern politics. This isn't about speech making. You know, speech making just back then was far broader. Plato means any form of communications about the world relevant to power struggles. Speech connected to knowledge is another matter. That's a lecture. Their expertise communicates itself. Oratory can help, but only as a very secondary issue. Oratory is not a part of any other body of knowledge. All it can do is manipulate. What Socrates is referring to is the role of advertising, public relations, media control, rather than speech making. It refers to all forms of communication that the wealthy can afford, including modern academics. Plato says, I'm referring to the ability to persuade by speeches, judges in law court, counselors in a council meeting, assemblymen in assembly, or any other political gathering that might take place. In point of fact, with this ability, you will have the doctor for your slave, and the physical trainer too. As for the financial expert of yours, he'll turn out to be making more money for somebody else instead of himself, for you, in fact, if you've got the ability to speak and to persuade the crowds. This is a direct attack on, you know, public relations and marketing. Again, like journalism, like oratory, marketing isn't an academic field. It's not a field at all. If you have no right to rule, you hire marketers. When someone has no right to rule, when you take over and you want to keep your rule secret, you hire someone like Gorgias. And this dialogue was, he's defending a world of corruption. I said in the beginning of this talk that in Plato's corpus, universal corruption means that the forms are very separate from society. Radically so. You can see them in great detail. The battle lines are drawn. When societies are more or less just, you can see them more manifest in institutions. In other words, the distinction between the ideal good and reality is such that we're not even using the same language. Someone, an orator or a politician, is persuading people, pretending to be knowledgeable in the field, by presenting information in a way that seems irrefutable. But it's not really imparting information, but concealing it. It's manipulation, it's psychological manipulation. The whole arsenal of Madison Avenue advertising that preys on the psychological weakness of its victims. The orator is a liar. The rhetorician is a liar. The journalist is a liar. I said this 1,000 times. Journalists are not experts in the field in which they write about. That's strange. They're trained in how to find an angle, a story. So what you're getting in the papers isn't politics, isn't power, isn't reality at all. Whatever name you want to put on it, you know, oratory is not a craft in itself, since it's not based on any knowledge. Marketing is the same way. It produces nothing. It can only act as a parasite on those crafts that do produce things. And of course, the orator will be quite preoccupied with freedom of speech and moral relativism. He may be worried that people will recognize the power of oratory and want to regulate it. Making a doctor your slave because you have this ability because the system, the social sanction pushes you in a different direction, is something frightening. For Athens, dedicated, as Socrates says, to freedom of speech, this declaration of open season on the unsuspecting. Freedom of speech seems far less pleasant when the power of these orators is taken into consideration. But it's not about civic activism. Freedom of speech is about the power of Madison Avenue. So what Plato and Hegel are talking about here is situating the idea of the individual, the autonomous individual, that is, the free individual, in a context of truth. Again, the modern world prides itself on its mathematical precision with everything except how to behave. We see the will to power on the streets today as corporate America finances the destruction of these cities. Ultimately, it comes down to, the rule of nominalism, of oratory, of financial assets. Wall Street has been given so far $8 trillion. Price fixing, so to speak. It's buying up trillions of corporate debt. And therefore, it keeps prices artificially high so that profits continue to come into the elite no matter what happens with the rest of the economy. This is why they're not concerned with the devastation that's been inflicted on the economy since February. They'll be raking in massive profits in the stock market while the real economy slips into absolute long-term depression. The use of the racial violence is a way to silence any real opposition from those who threaten the ruling class, which are intelligent whites. And as things get worse and worse, you'll have this huge underclass that is willing to work for anything. And their self-esteem will be completely destroyed. Crushing white self-esteem is essential. No one with low self-esteem is going to rebel because they don't believe they have a right to do it. It seems odd to connect this with corporations crashing their own economy, but in a system this irrational, it's true. This is what the world of nominalism and marketing leads to. The whole concept here is to situate the individual, understand what these terms mean. People scream these words without any knowledge or understanding. Freedom to do what? Why do lives matter? Or specific lives matter? What are these people going to do that's so important? So human services are going to be crushed, budgets slashed, and the cities policed by Antifa, Black Lives Matter, and psychologists, apparently, according to the city council members in the big cities. That's the ultimate result of truth leaving the city. The distinction between the will to power on the one hand and the common good on the other. They have nothing in common. There's no points in common. Regardless of what you may think of Trump, he is the only voice right now for the common good. He might not even mean it, but he is. We have no functioning institutions to fight the massive corporate juggernaut that is Black Lives Matter. And most of them are white and Jewish anyway. That's not the point. That's the thin end of the wedge. This is what happens when you destroy the legitimate autonomy of the person. Autonomy can't be had without historical situation. To know exactly who you are and where you come from and why you should be proud of this. This is connected with freedom. It's not a secondary matter. A group of people without a history can't rebel because they can't do anything together. And that's the point. Thank you everyone for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.